Out on the street, the vans which have composed the fire corridor accelerate, the black one quickly catching up with the dream floater and the justice wagon. The bearded man in the turret throws one final round. It hits the blue U.S. mailbox outside the easy stop, putting a hole the size of a softball in it. Then the raiders turn left on Hyacinth and are gone. Rudy Toot, Freedom, and Tracker Arrow leave on Bear Street, disappearing into the mist which first blurs them and then swallows them. In the Carver house, Ralphie and Ellen are shrieking at the sight of their mother, who has collapsed in the doorway leading to the hall. She isn't unconscious. Her body snaps furiously as convulsions tear through her. Blood splatters from her shattered face in ropes, and she is making a complicated sound deep in her throat, a kind of singing growl.
Mommy! Mommy!
Ralphie screams. Jim Reed is losing his battle to keep the twisting, struggling boy from running to the woman dying in the kitchen doorway. Johnny and Brad are coming down the stairs on their fannies, a riser at a time. But when Johnny gets to the bottom and understands what is happening, he gets to his feet and runs, first kicking aside the battered in-screen door, then crunching through the remains of Kirsten's beloved Hummels.
No, get down!
Brad yells at him, but Johnny pays no attention. He's thinking only one thing, and that is to separate the dying woman from her kids as fast as he can. They don't need to see the rest of her suffering.
Mommy!
Ellen howls, trying to wriggle out from under Cammy. The girl's nose is bleeding. Her eyes are wild, but hellishly aware.
Mommy!
Unhearing, the days of caring about her children and her husband and her secret ambition to someday create beautiful Hummel figures of her own all behind her, Kirsten Carver jitters mindlessly in the doorway. She growls and sings, sounds which are almost words.
Get her out!
Cammy yells at Johnny. She stares at Pi with terror and pity.
Away from the kids, for Christ's sake!
Then Belinda is there to help him. They carry Kirsten into her living room and set her on a couch that she agonized over for weeks and which is now bleeding stuffing from a gaping hole. Brad backs up before them to give them room, throwing nervous glances over his shoulder at the street, which appears once again to be deserted.
Well, don't ask me to sew it,
Pi says in an arch tone of voice, then gives a horrible, choked laugh. The cushion under her head is growing dark, the bloodstain spreading visibly as the three of them stand looking down at her. Then the convulsions resume. In the house next door, Tom Billingsley has gone on trying to save Marielle's life, even at the height of the attack, working with the aplomb of a battlefield surgeon. Now she is sewn up, and the bleeding is down to a muddy seep through a triple fold of gauze. But when he looks up at Collie, old Doc shakes his head. He is actually more upset by the cries from next door than by the operation he has just performed. He doesn't have much feeling about Marielle Sauderson, but he's almost positive the woman crying out over there is Kirsty Carver, whom he likes very much.
Boy, oh boy, he says out loud.
Collie looks towards Gary, wanting to make sure he's out of earshot, and spots him poking around in Doc's kitchenette, oblivious to the screaming and the weeping children next door, unaware that the operation on his wife is finished, opening and closing cupboards with the thoroughness of a dedicated alcoholic hunting for booze. His look into the fridge for beer, or maybe some chilled vodka, was an understandably short one. His wife's arm is in there, on the second shelf. Collie put it in himself, sliding stuff around, salad dressing, pickles, the mayonnaise, some leftover sliced pork and saran wrap, until there was room for it. He doesn't think it will ever be reattached, not even in this age of miracles and wonders. But he still couldn't bring himself to put it in Doc's pantry. Too warm. Will draw the flies.
Is she going to die? Collie asks.
Don't know, Billingsley says. He pauses, takes his own look at Gary, sighs, runs his hands through his Albert Einstein tangle of white hair.
Probably, if she doesn't get to a hospital soon.
Cynthia grabs a newspaper that has fallen to the living room floor during the rumpus, rolls it up, and crawls slowly to the front door. She uses the newspaper to sweep broken glass. There's a surprising amount of it out of her way as she goes. Steve thinks of objecting, asking her if she maybe has a death wish, then stows it. Sometimes he gets ideas about things. Pretty strong ones, as a matter of fact. Once, while peacefully reading palms on the boardwalk in Wildwood, he had an idea so strong that he quit the job that very night. It was about a laughing 17-year-old girl with ovarian cancer, malignant, advanced, maybe a month beyond any possible human remedy. Not the sort of idea you wanted to have about a pretty, green-eyed high school kid if your life's motto was no problem. The idea he's having now is every bit as strong as that one, but quite a bit more optimistic. The shooters are gone, at least for the time being. There's no way he can know that, but he feels certain of it just the same. Instead of calling Cynthia back, he joins her. The inside door has been blown open by several gunshots, and the breeze coming through the shattered screen is heaven, sweet and cool on his sweaty face. The kids are still crying next door, but the screaming has stopped, at least for the time being. "Where is he?" Cynthia asks, sounding stunned. "Look, there's his wife." She points to Mary's body, which is now lying in the street, tendrils of her hair wavering in the water rushing down the west side gutter. "But where is he?" "Mr. Jackson." Steve points through the torn lower half of the screen. "In that house." "Must be. See his glasses on the path?" Cynthia squints, then nods. "Who lives there?"
"Mrs. Weiler and her nephew," Collie says from behind them.
They turn and see him squatting on his hunkers, looking out between them.
"Boy's autistic or dyslexic or catatonic, one of those damned icks. I never can get him straight. Her husband died last year, so it's just the two of them. Jackson must...
He doesn't break off, but runs down, the words getting smaller and smaller, finally diminishing into silence. When he speaks again, his voice is still low and very thoughtful.
"What the hell?"
"What?" Cynthia asks uneasily. "What?"
"Are you kidding me? You don't see?"
"See what? I see the woman and I see your husband's..."
Now it's her turn to run down.
Steve starts to ask what the deal is, then understands, sort of. He supposes he would have seen it earlier, even though he's a stranger to the street, if his attention hadn't been diverted by the body, the dropped spectacles, and his concern for Mrs. Soderson. He knows what he must do about that, and more than anything else has been nerving himself up to do it. There has been a change over there since the coming of the shooters in the vans. Just how much he cannot tell, mostly because he is a stranger here. He doesn't know the street, partly because the smoke from the burning house and the mist still rising off the wet street give the houses over there a look which is almost spectral. But there has been a change. Siding has been replaced with logs on the Weiler house, and where there was a picture window, there are now three more conventional, old-fashioned, one might almost say, multi-paned windows. The door has wooden supports hammered across its vertical boards in a Z shape. The house next to it on the left...
"Tell me something," Collie says, looking at the same one.
"Since when did the Reeds live in a log fucking cabin?"
"Since when did the Gellers live in an adobe hacienda?" Cynthia responds, looking one farther down.
"I'm not sure I'm really seeing it," Collie says.
His voice is uncharacteristically hesitant. "It's shimmery," the girl says. He turns to her.
"Yeah, like when you look at something over the top of an incinerator or..."
"Somebody have my wife,"
Gary calls to them from the shadows of the living room. He has found a bottle of something. Steve can't see what. Gary isn't steady on his feet, and his words sound slurry.
"Somebody help Merrill. Loss her damn arm."
"We need to get help for her," Collie says, nodding, "and
for the rest of us," Steve finishes.
He's relieved, actually, to know that someone else realizes this, that maybe he won't have to go on his own. The boy next door has stopped crying, but Steve can still hear the girl sobbing in big, watery hitches. Margaret the Maggot, he thinks. That's what her brother called her. Margaret the Maggot loves Ethan Hawke, he said. Steve has a sudden urge, as strong as it is unaccustomed, to go next door and find that little girl, to kneel in front of her, take her in his arms and hug her, and tell her she can love anyone she pleases, Ethan Hawke or Newt Gingrich or just anybody. He looks down the street instead. The easy stop, so far as he can tell, hasn't changed. Its style is still late-century convenience store. Not beautiful, far from it, but a known quantity, and that's a relief. The rider truck is still parked in front. The blue phone sign is still hanging down from its hook. The Marlboro man is still on the door, and the bike rack is gone. Well, not gone exactly, replaced by something that looks suspiciously like a hitching rail in a Western movie. With an effort, he drags first his eyes and then his mind back to the cop, who is saying Steve is right, they all need help. At the Carvers as well as at old Doc's, by the sound. There's a green belt behind the houses on this side of the street, Collie says. There's a path that runs through it. Kids use it mostly, but I'm partial to it myself. Forks behind the Jackson's house. One arm runs down to Hyacinth, comes out by the bus shelter halfway down the block. The other one goes east, over to Anderson Avenue. If Anderson's, pardon my French, fucked up, why should it be? Cynthia asks. There hasn't been any shooting from that direction. He gives her a strange, patient look. There hasn't been any help from that direction either. And our street is fucked up in ways the shooting had nothing to do with, in case you haven't noticed. Oh, she says in a small voice. Anyway, if Anderson Avenue is as crazy as Poplar, I hope it isn't, but if it is, there's a viaduct that runs at least under the street, maybe further. It could go all the way to Columbus Broad. There's got to be people there. He doesn't look as if he really believes it, though. I'll go with you, Steve says. He sees Collie and Trajan thinking it over, and knows the cop is going to agree even before he opens his mouth. Nothing psychic about it, either. 4 people have been killed on Poplar Street this afternoon, not to mention the dog. More have been wounded. A house is burning flat without a single goddamn fire engine to attend it. There are crazy people running in the street, homicidal maniacs, and the guy would have to be insane to want to go creeping alone through the woods between here and the next block. What about him? Cynthia asks, jerking a thumb at Gary. Shape he's in. I wouldn't want to go to the movies with him, let alone into the woods with shit like this going down. But if you're serious, Mr. Ames, is it? Make it Steve, and I'm serious. Okay, let's see if old Doc's got a gun or two kicking around his basement. I bet he does. They start back across the living room, bent low. Cynthia turns to follow them, then movement catches her eye. She turns back and her mouth drops open. Revulsion follows surprise, and she has to put a hand to her mouth to stifle the cry that wants to come out. She thinks of calling the men back, then doesn't. What would it change? A buzzard. It might be a buzzard, although it looks like nothing she's ever seen in a book or a movie, has come cruising out of the billowing smoke from the Hobart house and landed in the street next to Mary Jackson. It's a huge, unnatural awkwardness with an ugly, peeled head. It walks around the corpse, looking for all the world like a diner reconnoitering the buffet before actually grabbing a plate, and then it darts its head forward and pulls off most of the woman's nose. Cynthia closes her eyes and tries to tell herself, this is a dream. Just a dream. It would be nice if she could believe it. From Audrey Wyler's journal, June 10th, 1995. Scared tonight, so scared. It's been quiet lately, with Seth, I mean. But now all that's changed. At first, neither of us knew what was wrong. Herb was gotten so pale and lost as much as 30 pounds, mostly since January or so, always trying to cheer me up, was as mystified as I was. We went out for ice cream at Millie's, part of our regular Saturday ritual if Seth is being good, which means if Seth is being Seth, and he was fine. Then, when we turned into the driveway, he started the sniffing thing he does sometimes, kind of raises his nose in the air and sniffs like a dog. I hate seeing him do that, and so does Herb. Herb asked him what was wrong as soon as he saw him doing it and got zilch. Not even the usual vocalizing stuff he does, just more sniffing. And once he was in the house, that stalking thing, walking from place to place as if his legs won't bend. He went out back to the sandbox. He went upstairs to his room. He went down cellar, all in that ominous silence. Just then he walked in, stalked in, with that horrible frown he gets on his face when something happens that doesn't fit into his general plan of life. Except it isn't him, it isn't. Seth is the sweetest, kindest, most accepting child I can imagine. But he has this other personality that we see more and more, the stiff-legged one, the one that sniffs the air like a dog. Herb asked him what was wrong, what was on his mind, and then all at once he, Herb I mean, reached up and grabbed his own lower lip, pulled it out like a window shade and started twisting it until it bled. And all the time his poor eyes were watering with pain and bugging out with fear, and Seth was staring at him with that hateful frown he gets, the one that says, I'll do anything I please, and you can't stop me. And maybe we can't, but I think that sometimes, at least, Seth can. Stop making him do that, I shouted at him. You just stop it right now. When the other one, the not Seth, gets really mad, his eyes seem to go from brown to black. He turned that look on me then, and all at once my hand came up and I slapped myself across the face, so hard my eye watered on that side. Make him stop, Seth, I said. It's not fair. Whatever's wrong, we're not responsible for it. We don't even know what it is. Nothing at first. Just more of the black look. My hand went up again, and then the hateful way he was looking at me changed a little. Not much, but enough. My hand went down, and Seth turned and looked up into the open cabinet over the sink where we keep the glasses. My mother's are on the top shelf, nice Waterford crystal that I only take down for the holidays. They were up there anyway. They burst when Seth looked at them, one after the other, like ducks in a shooting gallery. When they were gone, the 11 of them that were left, he looked at me with that mean, gloating smile he gets sometimes when you cross him and he hurts you for it, his eyes so black and somehow old in his child's face. I started to cry, I couldn't help it. Called him a bad boy, told him to go away. The smile slipped at that. He doesn't like to be told anything, but that least of all. I thought he might make me hurt myself again, but then Herb stepped in front of me and told him the same thing. To go away and calm down, and then come back and maybe we could help him fix whatever was wrong. Seth went off, and I could tell even before he got across the living room to the stairs that the other one was either gone or going. He wasn't walking in that horrible, stiff way anymore. Herb calls it Seth's Rudy the Robot walk. Then later, we could hear him crying in his room. Herb helped me clean up the glasses, me bawling like a fool the whole time. He didn't try to comfort me or jolly me out of it with any of his jokes, either. Sometimes he can be very wise. When it was done, he said the obvious, that Seth had lost something. I said, no shit, Sherlock, what was your first clue? Then felt bad and hugged him and said I was sorry. I didn't mean to be a bitch. Herb said he knew that, then turned over the stupid Baptist track we found in the mailbox and wrote on the back of it, what are we going to do? I shook my head. Lots of times we don't even dare say stuff out loud for fear he's listening. The not Seth, I mean. Herbie crumpled the tract and threw it in the trash, but that wasn't good enough for me. I took it out and tore it to shreds. But first I found myself looking at the sweaty, tortured face on the front of it. Welcome to hell. Is that Herb? Is it me? I want to say no, but sometimes it feels like hell. A lot of times, actually. Why else am I keeping this diary? June 11, 1995. Seth sleeping. Exhausted, maybe. Herbie outside in the backyard, looking everywhere. Although I think Seth has already been looking. We know what's missing now, at least. His dream floater power wagon. He's got all the MotoCop shit. Action figures, HQ crisis center, Cassie's party pad, power wagon corral, 2 stun pistols, even float pad sheets for his bed. But more than anything, he loves the power wagons. They're battery-powered vans, quite large, very futuristic. Most have wings he can pop out by pushing a lever on the bottom, plus radar dishes that really turn on the roofs. The one on Cassie Stiles' dream floater is shaped like a valentine. This after about 30 years worth of talking about equal rights and female role models for girls, I could just about puke. Flashing lights, siren noises, space blaster noises, etc., etc. Anyway, Seth came back from California with all 6 that are currently on the market. The red one, Tracker Arrow, the yellow one, Justice Wagon, the blue one, Freedom, the black one, Meat Wagon, belongs to the bad guy, the silver one, Rudy Toot, and just think, somebody gets paid to think this shit up, and the stupid pink one, driven by Cassie Stiles, the love of our young nephew's life. His crush is actually sort of funny and sweet, but there's nothing funny about what's currently going on around here. Seth's dream flota is gone, and all this is a kind of tantrum. Herbie shook me awake at 6 this morning, pulled me out of bed. I asked him what was wrong, and he couldn't say. Just pulled me over to the window and asked me if I saw anything out there. I could tell what he meant was, did I see what he was seeing? I saw it all right. It was Dream Floater, which looks sort of Art Deco, like something from the old Batman comic books. But it wasn't Seth's Dream Floater, not the toy. That's about 2 feet long and maybe 1 foot high. The one we were seeing was full-sized, probably 12 feet long and maybe 7 feet high. The roof hatch was part way up, and the heart-shaped radar dish was turning, just as it does on the show. Jesus Christ, I said. Where did that come from? All I could think was that it must have flown in on its stubby little retractable wings. It was like getting out of bed with one eye open and discovering a flying saucer has landed in your backyard. I felt like someone had punched me in the stomach. At first, when he told me it wasn't there, I didn't understand what he meant. And then the sun came up a little more, and I realized I could see the aspens behind our fence, right through it. It really wasn't there. But at the same time, it was. He's showing us what he couldn't tell us, Herb said. I asked if Seth was awake, and Herb said no. He'd been down the hall to check, and Seth was fast asleep. That gave me a chill I can't describe, because it meant we were standing there at our bedroom window in our PJs and looking out at our nephew's dream. We stood there for about 20 minutes watching it. Then it started to fade until it was just a shimmer. By the end, you couldn't have told what it was if you hadn't seen it when it was brighter. Then we heard Seth getting up and going down the hall. By the time the toilet flushed, it was gone. At breakfast, Herb pulled his chair over next to Seth's, the way he does when he really wants to talk to him. In some ways, I think Herb is braver than I ever could be, especially since it's Herb that's... No, I won't put that down. Anyway, Herbie puts his face close to Seth's so that Seth has to look at him, and then talks in a low, kind voice. He tells Seth we know what's wrong, why he's so upset, but not to worry because Cassie's power wagon is sure to be in the house or in the backyard somewhere. We'll find it, he says. All during this, Seth was fine. He kept eating his cereal and his face didn't change. But sometimes you just know it's him and that he's listening and understanding at least a little. And then Herb said, "And if we absolutely can't find it, we'll get you a new one." And everything went to hell. Seth's cereal bowl went flipping across the room, spilling milk and cereal all over the kitchen floor. It hit the wall and broke. The drawer under the stove came open, and all the things I keep under there, frying pans, cookie sheets, muffin tins, came flying out. The dishwasher supposedly can't start with the door open, but it did, and water went all over the floor. Scariest of all was the toaster. It was on, and I was making a couple of slices to have with my OJ, and all at once it glowed bright red inside the slots, as if it was a furnace instead of a little counter gadget. The handle went up, and the toast flew all the way up to the ceiling. It was black and smoking. Looked nuclear. It landed in the sink. Seth got up and walked out of the room, his stalky walk. Herb and I looked at each other for a second or two, and then he said, "That toast would probably taste okay with a little peanut butter on it." I just gaped at him at first, and then I started laughing. That got him started. We laughed and laughed, with our heads down on the kitchen table, trying to keep him from hearing, I guess, except that's stupid. Seth doesn't always have to hear to know. I'm not sure it's mind reading he does exactly, but it's something. Now it's 3 in the afternoon, and we have been all over the GD house, as my old school friend Jan would say. Seth has tried to help in his own peculiar way. It kind of broke my heart to see him turning up the sofa cushions, as if his missing van could have slipped under there like a quarter or a crust of pizza. Herb started out hopeful, saying it was too big and bright to miss, and I thought he was right. As a matter of fact, I still think he's right. So how come we can't find it? Noises upstairs. Seth's getting up from his nap, so I need to finish this, put it out of sight, try to put it out of mind, too. That should be okay, though. I think Seth has more success picking up what Herb is thinking than he does with me, and I've been careful not to tell Herb that I'm keeping a journal. I know what anyone reading the journal would say. We're nuts. Nuts to keep him. Something is wrong with him, and we know it's dangerous. So why go on? I don't know exactly. Because we love him? Because he's controlling us? Sometimes there are things like that, Herb twisting his lip or me slapping myself, things like a powerful hypnosis, but not often. He's mostly just Seth, a child in the prison of his own mind. He's also the last little bit of my brother. But sure, beyond all that, it's just loving. And every night when Herb and I lie down, I see in my husband's eyes what he must see in mine, that we made it through another one. And if we made it through today, we can make it through tomorrow. At night, it's easy to tell yourself that it's just another aspect of Seth's autism. Really, no big deal. Footsteps overhead. He's going to the bathroom. When he finishes, he'll come downstairs, hoping we've found his missing toy. But which one will hear the bad news? Seth, who'll only look disappointed and maybe cry a little, or the other one? The stalky one who throws things when he can't have what he wants. I'm so afraid. At the moment of Kirsten Carver's death, Johnny was thinking of his literary agent, Bill Harris, and Bill's reaction to Poplar Street. Pure, unadulterated horror. Good agent that he was, he had managed to maintain a neutral, if slightly glazed, smile on the ride from the airport. But the smile began to slip when they entered the suburb of Wentworth, which a sign proclaimed to be Ohio's good cheer community. And it gave way entirely when his client, who had once been spoken of in the same breath with John Steinbeck, Sinclair Lewis, and after delight, Vladimir Nabokov, pulled into the driveway of the small and perfectly anonymous suburban house on the corner of Poplar and Bear. "You can't be serious," Bill had said in a flat, disbelieving voice. "Oh, Bill, but I think I am. Johnny had responded, and something in his tone seemed to get through to Bill, enough at least so that when he spoke again, he'd sounded plaintive rather than disbelieving. "But why?" he asked. "Dear Jesus, why here? I can sense my IQ dropping, and I just fucking got here. First the goddamn putty-tat detective, and now a neighborhood where fruit cocktail is probably considered a delicacy. Tell me what the deal is, okay?" And Johnny had said, "Okay, the deal is, it's all over." "No, of course not." Belinda had said that. Not Bill Harris, but Belinda Josephson just now. Johnny cleared his mind with an effort and looked around. He was sitting on the living room floor, holding one of Kirsten's hands in both of his. The hand was cold and still. Belinda was leaning over Kirsty, her eyes tearless, but there was an expression of love and sorrow on her face that moved Johnny's heart. She was wiping Kirsten's blood-masked face with a dish towel, uncovering what remained of her features. "Did you say..." Johnny began.
"You heard me."
Belinda held the stained dish towel out without looking, and Brad took it. She took the white linen napkin that had been on her shoulder, unfolded it, and spread it over Kirsten's face. "God have mercy on her soul." "I second that," Johnny said. There was something hypnotic about the small red poppies blooming on the linen. Three on one side of the draped shape that was Kirsten's nose, two on the other, maybe half a dozen above her brow. Johnny put his hand to his own brow and wiped away a palm full of sweat. "Jesus, I'm so sorry." Belinda looked at him, then at her husband.
"We're all sorry, I guess. Question is, what's next?"
Before either man could answer, Cammy Reed came into the room from the kitchen. Her face was pale but composed. "Mr. Marinville?" He turned to her. "Johnny." She had to mull it over. Another classic case of shock-slowed thinking before understanding that he wanted her to call him by his first name. Then she got it and nodded. "Johnny. Okay, sure. Did you find the pistol, and are there any bullets to go with it?"
"Yes, to both."
"Can I have them? My boys want to go for help. I've thought it over and have decided to give them my permission. If you'll let them take David's gun, that is." She gave him a level look, no sign of impatience in her eyes or voice, but she fingered a spot of blood on her blouse as she spoke, a souvenir of Ellen Carver's nosebleed. "I'm aware of the danger, and if it were a question of using the street, I'd say no. But the boys know a path which runs through the greenbelt behind the houses on this side. They can use it to go over to Anderson Avenue. There's a deserted building over there that used to be a moving company's warehouse."
"Leiden Brothers," Brad said, nodding.
"And a water pipe that runs from the lot behind it all the way over to Columbus Broad, where it empties into a stream. If nothing else, they can get to a working phone and report what's going on here. Cam, do either of your boys know how to use a gun?" Brad asked. Again, the level stare. One which did not quite come out and ask, "Why do you insult my intelligence?" They both took a safety course with their dad 2 years ago. The primary focus was on rifles and hunting safety, but handguns were covered, yes. "If Jim and Dave know about this path, the shooters who are doing this may too," Johnny said. "Have you thought about that?"
"Yes."
The impatience finally showing, but only a little. Johnny admired her control. "But these lunatics are strangers. They have to be. Have you ever seen any of those bands before today?"
"I may have at that," Johnny thought.
"I'm not sure where yet, but if I can just get a little time to think."
"No, but I believe..."
"We moved here in 1982, when the boys were three," Cammy said. "They say there's a path that hardly anyone knows about or uses except for kids, and they say there's a pipe. I believe them."
"Sure you do," Johnny thought, "but that's secondary. So's the hope of their bringing back help. You just want them out of here, don't you?"
"Of course you do.
And I don't blame you."
He got up, pulled the pistol from the waistband of his slacks with one hand, pulled the box of cartridges out of his shirt pocket with the other. I'll be glad to turn this over to your boys, but I'd like to go along with them. Cammy glanced down at Johnny's belly, not as large as Brad's, but still considerable. She said, "The boys play soccer in the fall and run track in the spring. Can you keep up with them, Johnny?"
"Are you kidding yourself or what?" Belinda asked abruptly. It was Cammy she was talking to. "I mean, if there was still a working phone within earshot of Poplar Street, do you think we'd be still sitting here with dead people lying out front and the house burning to the ground?"
Cammy glanced at her, touched the blood spot on her blouse again, then looked back at Johnny. Behind her, Ellie was peering around the corner into the living room. The girl's eyes were wide with shock and grief, her mouth and chin streaked with blood from her nose. "If it's okay with the boys, it's okay with me," Cammy said, not addressing Belinda's question at all. Cammy Reed currently had no interest in speculation. Now there was only one thing that did interest her, rolling the dice while she judged the odds were still heavily in her favor, rolling them and getting her sons out the back door. "It will be," he said, and handed her the gun and the cartridges before heading back toward the kitchen. They were good boys, which was nice. And they were also boys who had been programmed to go along, in 9 cases out of 10, with what their elders wanted. In this situation, that was even nicer. As Johnny walked, he touched the object he had stowed in his left front pants pocket. "But before we go, it's important that I talk to someone. Very important."
"Who?"
Cammy asked. Johnny picked Ellen Carver up. He hugged her, kissed one blood-stained cheek, and was glad when her arms went around his neck and she hugged him back fiercely. "You couldn't buy a hug like that." "Ralphie Carver," he said, and carried Ralphie's sister back into the kitchen. Tom Billingsley did have a couple of guns kicking around, but first he found Collie a shirt, an old Cleveland Browns tee with a rip under one arm. Better than trying the path through the green belt naked from the waist up. Collie had used the route often enough to know there were blackberry bushes, plus assorted other prickers and brambles out there. In the corner of Doc's basement, beyond the ping-pong table, was a jumble of fishing equipment, a few orange hunting vests, and an unstrung bow. He squatted with a grimace, moved the vests, and uncovered a quilt that had been rolled and tied with twine. Inside it were 4 rifles, but 2 of them were in pieces. He held up the ones that were whole.
"Should do," he said.
Collie took the .30-06, which probably made a lot more sense for a woods patrol than his service pistol. That left Ames with the other, smaller gun, a Mossberg.
"It's only chambered for .22s,
Doc said apologetically as he rummaged in a cabinet and laid out cartons of cartridges.
"But it's a fine gun, just the same. Holds 9 in a row."
Cynthia had put a pillow under Marielle's head, but she was still lying on the living room floor. They hadn't dared move her. Billingsley was afraid his stitches might tear open again. She was still alive and still unconscious, which might be good, considering what had happened to her, but she was breathing in great, irregular gasps. Her husband, the charming Gary, was sitting in a kitchen chair which he had turned around so he could at least look at his wife while he drank the bottle he had found of Mother DeLuca's best cooking sherry.
"Lost her damn arm," he told Collie in a furry, confiding voice. "God help her."
"Yes," Collie said, "we're going to get her some help."
"I'll be here already. Lost her motherfucking arm. Zim motherfucking fritch."
Cynthia joined them. "You used to be a vet, didn't you, Mr. Billingsley?" Billingsley nodded. "I thought so. Could you come here? Take a look at something out the front door?" She led Billingsley across the living room to the door looking out on Poplar Street. Collie glanced at Steve, who shrugged.
"Holy shit," he said to Steve as they reached the door. "They've gone back to normal. Or did we just imagine they'd changed? 10 minutes ago, looking out this same door, he could have sworn that the Geller place had turned into an adobe. Now it was clad in plain old Ohio aluminum siding again.
We didn't imagine it, and things haven't gone back to normal, Steve said. At least not all the way back. Check that one.
Collie followed Steve's pointing finger and stared at the Reed house. The modern aluminized siding had returned, replacing the logs, and the roof was once more neat asphalt shingles instead of whatever it had been before. Sod, he thought. The mid-sized satellite dish was back on top of the carport. But the house's foundation was rough wood planking instead of brick, and all the windows were tightly shuttered. There were loopholes in those shutters, too, as if the inhabitants of the house expected their day-to-day problems to include marauding Indians.
Say, Billingsley said, are those hitching rails in front of Audrey's? They are, aren't they? What is all this?
Never mind that, Cynthia said. She reached up and turned the old man's face so he was looking at the corpse of Peter Jackson's wife.
Oh, my God, Collie said.
There was a large bird perched on the woman's bare thigh, its yellow talons buried in her skin. It had already snacked off most of her face. Collie didn't realize he had lifted the .30-06 into firing position until Steve pushed the barrel back down with the palm of his hand.
Better to keep quiet, maybe.
He was right, but God, it wasn't just what it was doing, but what it was.
My good gosh, look at that, Doc exclaimed in a tone that sounded very much like awe.
Is that a buzzard? Cynthia asked. Or maybe a vulture?
Old Doc looked startled. Good God, no. I've never seen a bird like that in my life. Look how big its body is, and how short its wings are in relation to it. I don't think the wings are even the same length. How can it possibly fly?
I don't know, but it does. Cynthia pointed down toward the thick billows which had now blotted out all vestiges of the world below Hyacinth Street. It flew out of the smoke. I saw it.
I'm sure you did. But how it can is beyond all...
He broke off, peering at the thing.
It does look a little like a buzzard. As a child might draw it, anyway. Perhaps one who got it all mixed up in his mind with a bald eagle...